Welcome to the Omfit Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the OMFIF podcast. My name is Bhavin Patel and you are listening to part one of this discussion with Charles Chang, the Deputy Dean of Academics and the Director of the FinTech Research Centre at the Van Hai International School of Finance at the Fudan University. We are also joined by Douglas Arner, Kerry Holdings Professor in Law and Director of Asian Institute of International Financial Law at the University of Hong Kong. Welcome to both of you. In this two-part series, we hope to discuss the Chinese fintech space, specifically focusing on payments, regulations, and the Chinese Central Bank Digital Currency Project. So thank you, Charles and Douglas, for joining me today. Douglas, maybe we can start with you with the first question. So trends in payment solutions and behavior, that means there is an affinity towards digital payments in China. We know that China is leading globally in both fintech, investment, mobile payment usage. Approximately the value of total mobile payments in China is 17% of GDP, while in the US is only about 0.6%. Maybe you can ask you why is China ahead compared to the rest of the world, and how has big tech in China played a role in this growth?
Thanks, Bhavin, and thanks to you and your colleagues for the invitation to be here today. Very happy to be speaking with you and Charles about these issues. Yeah, I think it's been interesting that if we look at digital payments over the past 10 years or so, where invariably we've seen the fastest growth, is in those places where you didn't already have relatively effective payment systems. So in other words, places like Hong Kong or the United States, electronic payments have developed relatively more slowly. In Kenya or in the context of China, you've seen much more rapid development. And I think part of that was the opportunity that is presented by leapfrogging. And I think if we're looking in the context of China, there were a couple of other factors as well. And the first was a developmental path meant that mobile phone penetration increased very rapidly, particularly from the beginning of this century, to a point where you have very high mobile phone penetration rates, and also often coupled with availability of mobile internet from around 10 years ago. And I think that particular combination, widespread availability of mobile phones combined with access to mobile communications technology, meant that the groundwork was there. And because there was a lack really of a reasonably effective solution otherwise, in the standpoint of, say, card penetration or use of mechanisms like checks, that the possibility of moving very rapidly and leapfrogging was there. I would also add in the fact that e-commerce found a very fertile environment, really for the past 10 plus years in China, largely because of the spread out nature of the country, as well as urban areas where you can have very large transport times in an urban area. And if you're thinking about something like spending an hour or two to cross a city to find that something isn't there, only to have to spend an hour or two to go back, one can immediately see the attractions of e-commerce, both in large urban areas, as well as outside those urban areas where you wouldn't have the same sorts of availability, and therefore that demand for e-commerce supported a need for electronic payments. And I think very much an iterative process between the two, and combine that with the possibility, indeed the need for leapfrogging, plus a rapidly urbanizing, educated, tech-aware society, gave us the ground to allow what we have seen to happen when we combine it with technological innovation, and particularly network effects, economies of scope and scale.
Thank you, Douglas. I think the organic demand is very present through Asia for that digital means of inclusion and payment. Charles, just to move to you, we have seen concerns around the influence and competitive behaviors of American big tech firms and the approach that has been taken to manage this by the American legislature domestically. But how is the Chinese approach different, and how will China oversee the behaviors of its technology powerhouses on and off its shores?
Also, thank you for the invite today, and I really enjoyed actually already Douglas's first answer. Let me just play off of that for a moment, because I think it's related to your second question. I couldn't agree more. I mean, if you came to China, you wouldn't know. People here wouldn't know what a checkbook looked like. So, I mean, you could give them one, but they wouldn't know what it is. And I think that actually has to do with this China approach. And the approach has been adoption, adoption, adoption. And I think part of that comes with the fact that China has found a way to do this planned economy thing in such a way that it behaves as a compass and people actually go in that direction. So whereas we have, you know, the sort of economic modality that says, you know, competition is best, in that free economy sense, you know, China over the past, you know, call it 40 years has taken a very different ilk, has said, well, let's try to do this in a planned way. And let's give everyone a lighthouse or a beacon or a compass, if you will, and say, you know, these are the things that, you know, we're going to try to do. So, for example, you know, we're going to try to do nationwide infrastructure of supply chains to go along with our retail and our payment. So as we started to see China become an important hub for global supply chains, it was entirely consistent then for us to say, well, let's also make ourselves a bellwether or role model for doing internal domestic shipping. And nobody does last mile delivery like China does. So it's not surprising then that with all those matching pieces in place, that the electronic payments and what have you have matched. And so when we look at companies like the early birds like HNet, and then of course Alibaba and Alipay and all of those that then came after, I think China's approach has been to say, okay, we're going to open these pieces up piece by piece, and we're going to give that compass. We're going to say, okay, let's try to move in this direction. And there's a Chinese saying about being, you know, sort of the middle kingdom and all things in moderation. Let's start with a test zone. And let's give, you know, 5, 10, 15 guys a chance to do that. But let's keep that out of the true mainstream for a period of time. So we see the so-called free trade zones and that sort of thing that we're seeing in the last 10 years. And that stretches back 20 or 30. And let's say, let's put these sandboxes together before it was fashionable to use that term. And let's give some people the opportunity to try and let that build out. Things that don't work, we eliminate. Things that do, we continue to build on. But in a directed way, right? In a way where, to a certain degree, when we say planned, we also mean protected. That those early entrepreneurs will enjoy, you know, certain first mover advantages that maybe the pure free market competitive behavior doesn't. And that eliminates actually the need for that, you know, the squeezing out of that last 2 or 3% margins that may be where some of the trouble then rears its head. So, you know, I think the fact that China has taken a sort of planned approach to its economic development, again, not just in payments and in fintech, but throughout the last 30 years, I think, you know, they're continuing to use that model now, and that's been giving a lot of their sort of so-called technological powerhouses, the Alibabas, the Tencents of the world, that comfortable space to work in. And that's what we're seeing, starting to see them being so influential on a global scale.
A question to you both. With the greater speed of adoption, Charles, which you mentioned, a lot of focus has been placed on the risks, especially more recently. So technology firms do present greater supervisory challenges to governments, not just because of their global footprint, but also because of the nature of some of their activities. So cybersecurity, individual privacy, and competitive concerns are not the concerns of a single governance function, but span across national security, domestic policy, and trade as well. So maybe Douglas can start with you. Who is best placed to govern a technology firm? And in your view, What is the current state of regulation in China with respect to new entrants in this area?
You know, I think this is emerging as one of the biggest questions and issues globally across the decade. And I think it's interesting that if we look at, say, the US, EU, and China, each of their different approaches to data firms, to tech firms. We can think of the US taking a very sort of laissez-faire approach to transfers, sales of information. We can think of, and that sort of leading eventually to the emergence of large firms. We can think of the EU sort of taking the opposite effect of putting personal control on data to try to prevent dominance by a few firms. And we can look in the context of China, and I think Charles makes a very good point then. If we look at the sort of approach of China, it's kind of a mix. On one side, it has had a very sort of free market approach to agglomerations of data, but at the same time, often a very close relationship between tech companies and data companies and the government. And I think what we are seeing emerging in each case is in some ways the natural result of what we think of as at the core of tech, but also financial services, and that is network effects, economies of scope and scale. And the eventual result of that is often, at the very least, a small number of very large players, or even a winner-takes-all situation. And I think what we're seeing across the EU, the US, and China is an increasing concern with that sort of concentration effect, first from the standpoint of innovation and competition. And I think particularly in the context of China, where the focus on innovation is so central to national direction, that the fears of a small number of dominant players potentially resulting in reduced innovation and therefore constraining the developmental horizons are really leading to activities to try to make sure that new entrants, new ideas, new approaches, innovation can come in. And I think that's something that we're also seeing very much in the US and the EU. And you know, it's something that if we look at this particular combination, not just of big tech, but of big tech and finance, what my team has called global digital finance platforms. And we're seeing a range of these emerging in different places. It's interesting because you sort of have a double impact of economies of scope and scale and network effects operating in both finance and data and tech industries. And we're working with the UN, the UN Task Force on Digital Financing of the Sustainable Development Goals, and looking at some of the challenges as well as the opportunities. And it has to be said that these sorts of firms are having a very important, powerful impact on development, on financial inclusion, on achievement of the SDGs. But we're also seeing increasingly a range of issues and concerns that are leading us to try to figure out how can we balance the risks with some of the opportunities. And I think we're seeing in China and elsewhere efforts of financial regulators so that if something is a financial activity, regardless of who's doing it, you want to bring it into the regulatory system. But at the same time, you want a sort of proportional, graduated approach to financial regulation. You don't want to over-regulate the small players. You don't want to under-regulate the big players. Likewise, from the standpoint of competition or antitrust regulation, we're seeing an increasing focus not just on consumer issues, consumer benefit, but also on these wider societal concerns around innovation, development, competitiveness. Likewise, if we think about data regulation, we're looking at it from the standpoint of cybersecurity, but we're also looking at it from the standpoint of data having a core role in finance, but also across our societies, and a concern both about how data is being used And this is just as much of a concern of the Chinese public as it is anywhere else, as well as how we can use data effectively to support development in society. And so from my standpoint, I don't necessarily think that there is a single approach, but rather there are issues that come up from a variety of different angles. And in all likelihood, it makes sense to have the individual regulators take a functional approach. With that said, I think where there is a financial institution involved, the trend globally historically has been to take a sort of top level approach, a group sort of approach to look at those issues. And I think it's very important to look to see, is something a tech firm? Or is it a financial services firm? And it doesn't matter if it's a tech firm which is doing financial services, that makes it a financial services firm. And I think that that is often where our differences come in.
Thank you, Douglas. Charles, is there anything more to add to what Douglas has just mentioned, not having blanket solutions to regulations, but almost approaching them case by case in some way?
I think this is a very complicated issue, right? I think, you know, when you talk about privacy, right, and that's the issue we're talking about here, you know, this is an incredibly cultural and moralistic topic. And to think that that would be consistent or homogeneous across countries is at best foolish and at worst egocentric, right? So I would think firstly that because this hinges so much upon how people even view the concept of privacy, that thinking there will be a singular solution is difficult. Now, that's not to say that that wouldn't appear in certain usage cases, okay? And there may be some that would fit it. But I think if you talk about it from a very broad strokes approach, in terms of how do we treat data and so forth, this is very cultural. So, I mean, just to give an example, you asked about China specifically. The Chinese have a much higher tolerance for data sharing and data usage than potentially, let's say, American counterparts. On the continuum of, is it useful to me to have this app use my data versus is there some potential, you know, data privacy issue down the line? Every day, and I mean every day, dozens of apps, the most popular apps in China, every day straddle that wall. And people are perfectly fine with it, right? Because it gives them in their mind more convenience than it does in terms of the way they view the risk of their data or their security. I mean, we keep in mind that, you know, there are already, for example, traffic cameras on every corner, four of them on each corner here as we sit in downtown Shanghai. And there is this pervading feeling that, you know, if I've not done anything wrong, so why would I care if anybody watches? Perhaps to a higher extent than in other countries. So I think it really is very much about how that culture and how those peoples view the very issue. I read a report not long ago that showed, this was in the Chinese media, that showed that the average citizen vastly prefers central regulation over trusting corporations. So again, even that might be a very different view, right? I'd rather the government regulate, let's say, Didi Chuxing, China's Uber, rather than trust Didi Chuxing itself to take care of things the right way. You know, so again, that may already be a very, very different view. And I think in China, as we start to see things like the central bank digital currency, things like the BSN being pushed out now, we're seeing China use and think about big data, even blockchain, as a tool for regtech and governance, as a tool for regulation, rather than, you know, the sort of decentralizing themes and what have you that may generally be thought to surround things like, you know, blockchain. So I think in light of that, you know, when we talked about what happens with innovation and how do we, you know, ensure that there's active innovation while at the same time, you know, having this sort of planned economy, I think part of what China's sort of direction on it has been, you know, and this is one of the years that we're seeing a new one, is, you know, we have these sort of 5-year plans, the 14th this year, and they try to drive, actively drive innovation by identifying areas where, okay, these areas we're going to, you know, we're going to go and we're going to push through, rather than sort of relying on activist entrepreneurship and having, again, more planned, more centralized way to do it. So it wouldn't surprise me if the issues of cybersecurity and privacy ultimately became a very cultural issue, and that in certain aspects, so for example, like SWIFT, right, where the world has sort of for many years decided, okay, as a group of banks and as a group of institutions, let's agree upon this way to do it. Perhaps with BSN now being pushed out, the blockchain service network being pushed out now in China for a similar task. I think there may be certain areas where an association or an alliance of international groups can put together and agree upon certain protocols. You know, there's been a lot of work in the G20 to look at central bank digital currency and to think about what protocols might be in that space. But I think in a very general term, I think our understanding of data privacy and security, and then how that should be rewarded, awarded, and protected, I think varies. And in that sense, I very much agree with Dr. Arner.
Thank you, Charles. I mean, that's a very interesting take on cultural views and data privacy. I mean, there is no single comprehensive data protection law in China, but there are rules regulating personal data protection and data security, like the PRC cybersecurity law, just to name one. Douglas, I just want to turn to you for a second. I think it's hard to avoid a conversation about fintech and payments without mentioning the PBOC's CBDC project. And I would just want to ask you possibly about the context of this project. Given that the private sector has dominated digital payments in China, with the two largest players covering about 90% of the market, what do you think the main policy objective is for the DCEP, and what can it fulfill that currently the private sector hasn't so far?
If we're looking at it, then the starting point is to think about from the standpoint of the functions of central banks, and core to central bank functions are really overall development. But that's often based on monetary policy, in particular monetary stability, and also financial stability. And if we think of it from that standpoint, monetary stability, trustworthy, stable, usable via payment system, monetary instrument, has emerged as a very important public good, which is a fundamental responsibility assigned to central banks all over the world, really from the beginning of the 20th century, if not before. And as a result, we can see that central banks are constantly looking at applications of technology to money and payment systems. If we think about the area where central banks have the most experience with technology, it's often payment systems, particularly in the context of dealing with large value payment and settlement systems or electronic government security systems. And as a result, these systems have a certain life. And central banks are constantly investigating new technologies, new ways of doing things. And what we saw with the emergence of Bitcoin and blockchain technology is central banks around the world beginning to investigate whether these sorts of distributed technologies could serve a useful role in addition to the roles being played by centralized technologies like RTGS systems. And so we can see People's Bank of China and a number of other central banks, PBOC, looking into DLT's potential applicability from around 2014 or so. And most central banks up until 2019 We're largely looking at this from an interest standpoint. Could it be useful? And often concluding that in many cases, it didn't offer necessarily a major advantage over existing centralized systems. And I think when we look at the world or the history of money and payment, mid-2019 is a key year. Why? Mid-2019, Facebook announces the proposal for Libra. And while many have had doubts about the arguments for that, very few have had doubts about the viability of the technology to make it happen. And as a result, this dramatically increased the level of attention given by central banks around the world to related projects, both from a regulatory standpoint across the G20 and the FSB, as well as from the standpoint of ongoing internal investigations and projects. And certainly in the case of China, that announcement dramatically sped up the process of looking at a central bank digital currency. And we see the announcement of trials later in sort of October of 2019. And of course, 2020 with COVID-19. COVID-19 has driven digitization, particularly digitization of payments everywhere. And this has refocused central banks around the world on how they can best use technology to get payments where they are most important from the standpoint of supporting economic activity. And so we can think of that in some ways as the catalyst. But if we look at the rationales for DCEP, a range of different rationales, certainly one is around financial inclusion. And we can think of financial inclusion from two sides. We can think of financial inclusion from the standpoint of foreign visitors coming to China. And certainly by mid-2019, when someone like me would go to mainland China, the difficulties in doing really much of anything, from getting a taxi to paying for just about anything, were very problematic. And so I think an effort to deal with that, particularly in advance of the upcoming Beijing Olympics, but also seeing it as an opportunity to address that sort of last mile that is not covered by the existing electronic and mobile payment systems throughout China. Second, Charles's point. If we look at blockchain, something that blockchain needs is a stable, trustworthy monetary instrument which can be embedded in transaction systems. And so far, cryptocurrencies have not proven effective for that. Likewise, we've seen the emergence of a range of stable coins, which likewise have not proven effective. And certainly co-authors and I at the BIS have argued that central bank digital currencies are a potential way to address this, to provide stable monetary instrument that can support blockchain development. And of course, in the context of China, where blockchain development is a national strategic priority, this makes a lot of sense. From the standpoint of monetary policy, to get better granular tracking of activities. From the standpoint of addressing potential competitors, particularly foreign competitors like Libra. And likewise, as Charles highlighted in the discussion of SWIFT, a potential mechanism to build a system or a platform which could reduce political risks inherent in over-reliance on the potential politicization of U.S. dollar-based structures. And so I think when we look at DCEP, we have to look at it from a variety of domestic examples or a variety of domestic directions, but also from the standpoint increasingly of how it could be used in the wider financial context.
Thank you, Douglas. That was very comprehensive and a good point made about blockchain needing CBDC as much as CBDC needs blockchain as well. On that final point, this concludes part one of this two-part series podcast. Thank you both for joining us today. The second half of this podcast will be released later in February, so please do look out for this on your own chosen podcast platform.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.